Okay, our next case is called People of the State of Colorado versus Brian Roberson, I believe it is. May I have the entry of appearances?
Andrew.
Thank you.
Lady Nesmer for the defenders.
Thank you. This is an argument which has been set for 1 hour. So each side has a half an hour. You'll need to keep track of your own time if you would, please. Mr. Cooper, are you ready? This is counsel.
May it please the court. Under the proper rule, where a convicted sex offender has requested and accepted a sentence to probation, knowing that he will be required to discuss his thoughts and behaviors in treatment, but refuses to do so on the ground that his answers could incriminate him in some future criminal case, his probation can be revoked so long as the state has not sought to override the invocation of the privilege by nonetheless demanding the answers. The state has not sought a waiver of his ability to later challenge the voluntariness of those statements in any later criminal case. And the state is not motivated by vindictiveness in retaliation against the exercise of a constitutional right. To touch upon why that is the correct rule, I'd like to discuss the penalty cases, how Minnesota versus Murphy fits into those cases, and why a prospective grant of immunity is not required. All of the penalty cases involved public employees who were asked questions in the context of criminal investigations. Here's the way to understand the penalty cases. Suppose a justice on this court had in her employment a law clerk who once a week was expected to respond to the question, what did you get done this week? One Friday, the justice asks, what did you get done this week? The law clerk replies, I declined to answer on the ground that it might tend to incriminate me. And it's a perfectly valid exercise of the privilege, because the reality is that the law clerk hasn't gotten any work done because the law clerk has spent a week engaged in a long string of criminal activity. Another week goes by, the justice asks the same question, and once again, the law clerk says, I decline to answer on the ground it could tend to incriminate me. Under the penalty cases, the justice absolutely can fire the law clerk because the law clerk has failed to respond to a question that is related to a condition of his ongoing employment. What the penalty cases prohibit is the justice hauling that law clerk in front of a grand jury or some other type of investigative tribunal and trying to override the assertion of the privilege by demanding the answers and insisting on a waiver of immunity if the person wants to keep the job, so that those answers can be used in a later criminal case. That's the penalty cases. When the logic of those cases is applied here, what it means is that just as a public employee's ongoing employment can be conditioned on the answering of questions that are related to the relationship, so too can a probationer's ongoing probation be conditioned on a willingness to answer questions that are related to the conditions of probation. And it does not matter that in either the employment context or the probation context, the refusal to answer questions manifests itself in the form of an invocation of the privilege. To dig a little deeper into the penalty cases, let me highlight three opinions from that long string of cases, because I think these three form a linchpin of those cases in a way that's very instructive here. I would ask that the court focus on two cases that were decided on the same day in 1968, Gardner versus Broderick and Uniform Sanitation Act. Both of those majority opinions were authored by Justice Forrest. And in his opinions in those cases, he cites to his concurring opinion in one of the 1967 cases that has been cited by the defense here, a case called Stebbick versus Klein. Now, Stebbick versus Klein is the only case in that line of cases that does not fit neatly into the pattern of the others. In all of the other cases, public employees were hauled in front of a grand jury or some other type of investigative tribunal and demanded to answer questions for the purpose of criminal prosecution. Stebbick versus Klein is different. Stebbick was not a public employee. He was a licensed attorney, and he was not hauled in front of a grand jury. Instead, he was brought before an attorney disciplinary proceeding and asked questions about his contingent fee arrangements, which I guess in 1967 were still unusual and somewhat controversial. Stebbick does not have a majority opinion. It's a 4-1-4 vote. There's a plurality opinion, and the decided vote, the fifth vote, is cast by Justice Fortas in his concurring opinion. If one reads together Fortas's opinions in the two 1968 cases, along with his concurrence, which he cites in the 68 cases, his concurrence from Stebbick versus Klein, an important distinction is seen, which is that unlike the public employees whose ongoing employment can be conditioned on answering questions about the job, the private attorney has no obligation to answer those questions because as a private employee or private attorney who's not an employee of the state, he does not need to answer questions in the way a public employee does or in the way that a probationer does. That's why Stebbick versus Klein is different. How does Minnesota versus Murphy fit into the penalty cases? Here's how. In Murphy, Murphy was on probation as a sex offender and required to discuss matters of treatment, but he abandoned his sex offender treatment program. Before he abandoned it, he acknowledged to his therapist that he had committed an earlier murder. The probation officer learned of that after he had abandoned the treatment program. And the probation officer, now really functioning as a cop, was interrogating Murphy for the pure purpose of then reporting the information, the confession about the murder to the police so that he could, so that Murphy could be prosecuted for it. Murphy did not invoke the privilege against self-incrimination, answered the questions, and in the criminal case, those statements were offered against him. The issue became, well, is the privilege of self-incrimination self-executing, or did he in effect waive it by not invoking the privilege? And in deciding that the privilege is not self-executing, the U.S. Supreme Court said that because he had abandoned his treatment program and was not answering these questions as part of the therapeutic probationary process, but instead was responding to questions from the probation officer for the pure purpose of a criminal investigation, a reasonable person in his position could not have thought that his probation could be revoked for the exercise of the privilege. And that's very much like the penalty cases, because just as a public employee can't be hauled in front of a grand jury or some other investigative tribunal and told that if you don't answer these questions, we're going to fire you, so too in the probation context, a probationer couldn't be asked a question purely for the purpose of criminal investigation and in response to an exercise of privilege be told your probation will be revoked because of that, because of your exercise of privilege. That's how Murphy fits in.
So here, Mr. Robertson was told that if he didn't answer the questions, his probation would be revoked. And so is that the end of it? Is that all we need to worry about?
What that means is that he understood what the condition of probation was. He then had a voluntary choice to make, as do other people in his position. We have sex offenders in our jurisdiction who were convicted at trial, placed on probation, have appealed their convictions, and their appeals are pending, and yet they, unlike this individual, have chosen to answer the questions, and they have counsel. They've chosen to answer the questions, I assume, because they've made what for them is a highly rational choice. For those offenders, they probably see that although they have a right to appeal and they will appeal, they probably don't have a very good chance of winning on appeal.
Mr. Cooper, I'm sorry to interrupt you, though. You don't have a whole lot of time. So, in your opinion, if a defendant is advised that a condition of his probation is that he answer these questions about his offense, and he chooses not to, is that sufficient? Is that the end of the inquiry? Do we write an opinion that says if that happens, you can revoke a defendant's probation?
Then the district court does have the discretion to revoke probation. The fact that the invocation has been invoked does not prohibit probation. I'm sorry, the fact that the privilege has been invoked does not prohibit the invocation of the privilege. The one, and there's a variety of reasons for that. Here's why Colorado's scheme as a whole is proper. In Colorado, probation is a voluntary choice. The individual can refuse to accept a probationary sentence. The process is also fair. There are all sorts of procedural protections. Revocation is not automatic, and I think that's significant because where it is automatic, that's more coercive. If someone is told, if you don't make the statement right now, you will be sent to prison, that's more likely to coerce someone than what we have here, which is simply that they're brought before the court and there's the possibility of a revocation.
That is kind of technical, though, isn't it? I mean, a condition of probation is to participate in the treatment. Therefore, you have to acknowledge, in effect, the underlying offense. So isn't every court going to just go ahead and revoke probation? I mean, in what circumstances would the person be able to continue probation without participating in the treatment?
You know, it might depend on what questions they're willing to answer and what questions they're not. There's different types of questions that probationers are asked in these treatment programs. One category is an entire sexual history in which they describe their whole history of behaviors and interests. That's very important to the probation department so that they can develop a safety plan based on what it is that triggers the person's interests. Then there's what's called the index offense, which is the offense for which the person was convicted, which from the therapist's perspective is just one incident of broad spectrum of behavior. And then there's recent behavior, maintenance behavior, which is important for polygraph examinations. The question might be, well, in the last 6 months, have you viewed any child pornography? All three of those categories of questions are potentially incriminating, whether it's an admission of a criminal offense in itself or a disclosure of some interest or behavior that furnishes a chain in the link of evidence against the person.
Well, Mr. Cooper, here the defendant said that he doesn't remember whether he committed the sexual offense or not because he was asleep at the time, and that was his defense. And then he found guilty and being sentenced to probation. Well, isn't requiring him to talk about the sexual offense inconsistent with his defense that he doesn't remember that he was asleep? The jury didn't believe that. Are we supposed to now assume that since the jury didn't believe that, he now has something to talk about? Well, run that out for me in this particular instance.
Well, he's not even, he's choosing when to speak and when not to. He chose to testify at trial. He chose to answer questions for the pre-sentence investigation. Once he was in treatment, he chose to invoke. Here's what it would mean, at least for him to respond in some way about his offense. He could, during probation, at least, make the same sort of statements that he made during the trial, which would be an account of his version of the event. I went to bed that night. I don't remember anything until the next morning, and this is how the event unfolded. He's not even saying that. He's not even saying that because he's invoking the privilege. And quite apart from this incident, which the jury rejected his version of the event, there are the other spectrum of questions. He's not answering the maintenance questions. Have you viewed anything or thought about anything within the last 6 months within a particular category? And he's not revealing the full sexual history. What interests have you had in the past? What is it that turns you on? Probation needs to know that to create a safety plan. If the individual discloses that, well, what interests him sometimes is if he sees a woman's ponytail bobbing back and forth as she's jogging along, then probation will say, you can't go to any public parks or gymnasiums or jogging trails or anywhere else where you might run into a female jogger who would have a ponytail. That's the idea of a safety plan. Probation has not been able to do that with this individual because he has refused to disclose any of those interests.
I don't want to take you too far from the initial question about privilege, but since we're going down this road, so what actually is the basis for revocation here? What's the condition that's violated as distinguished from simply finding that he hasn't successfully completed the program, therefore he can't get off probation?
Well, the probation condition is the successful completion of the program. And the reason he has not completed it is because he has not been successful.
And is successful completion of the program a basis for revoking probation or for simply indicating that you haven't completed? What I'm looking at is, I realize what SOMB may say in certain situations, but it appears from the nature of the case you brought us and others we've seen that courts are taking the approach that somehow this is statutorily required or there is a required condition with regard to sex offenders that they have to complete this program or actually participate in the program, maybe along the lines that Justice Hobbs said. And then I guess what I'm asking is what's the effect of not doing that? The statute, the 18.1.3.1008, whatever, just talks, it actually seems to contemplate, doesn't it, that a sex offender who's on an indeterminate period of probation, 10 to life, simply is not to be released from probation because he won't have completed it unless he successfully completes the program. I guess I'm wondering, who gets to say, and by the way, this ties in with your question, maybe you could put them all together with your answer that the judge doesn't have to revoke probation. How are those determinations made?
Well, ultimately, who gets to say is the district court judge. Even if that goes against the recommendations of the treatment program and probation, ultimately the judge should have that discretion.
So even if he's dismissed from the program for what they consider to be not participating, the judge could not revoke and what, say, put him back in the program?
Well, I guess that would be subject to an abuse of discretion review.
Okay.
But depending on the facts of the particular case, I guess one could imagine situations in which the district judge and the probation department reasonably disagreed about whether the person was safe to be in the community and had been successfully
reported. For time reasons, let me narrow my first question. So what exactly is the violation here? As for instance in this case, was there a condition of his probation that he would have to, was it written that he would have to admit, that he would have to talk, or just that he would have to participate in a program?
Well, the probation condition is the successful completion of the program. He was forewarned by the sentencing judge very clearly that, as a practical matter, that's going to require an admission of the conduct. That's what this sentencing judge said, was that if he remained in denial, that he would likely end up in prison. I don't think that at the sentencing, any particular formulation needs to be stated to give the person that degree of notice, which is why in the supplemental authorities, I mentioned this court's recent decisions in Moore and Walker. I don't think there's a specific litany. Those are the degrees of placement cases. There simply needs to be a constitutionally adequate notification of the person as to what the conditions of probation are. If that's true of any probation context, a person can't have the probation revoked if, for due process reasons, they were not adequately informed of what it was that they were supposed to do.
To drill down, to drill down a little bit on what Justice Coates seems to be getting at, is there some statutory provision under the Lifetime Supervision Act that allows the SOMB to promulgate rules that then define what constitutes successful completion? And is that then the predicate for saying you haven't successfully completed? Is that the statutory hook, if you will?
And I apologize, I don't know that I'm going to be able to articulate for you here the exact relationship between the statute and the SOMB guidelines in a way that would answer that question.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you a different one then, if you don't mind, which is what gave the trial judge the authority to say, and I think this is an exact quote, that this continued denial and you're going to be in prison for 10 years, or you're going to be 10 years to life in the state prison? Why did the trial judge have the authority to make that a condition of his probation? I understand that the trial judge has an authority to subject him to the Sexual Offender Management Board, the SOMB, but why does the trial judge have the authority to say, and you have to admit your crime?
Well, I think the legislature has delegated authority to the SOMB, and the SOMB has said that someone can remain in denial for only up to 3 months and safely remain in the community. What denial means, I think, is subject to a range of interpretation. What I'm told by the probation department is that as long as the individual is disclosing the full sexual history and discussing their interests from a therapeutic perspective, the therapist in the probation department can work with the person indefinitely without the admission to the index offense, the offense for which they were committed, because that's one incident on the spectrum of behavior. It's a very important aspect of the whole spectrum because it's what they're being held accountable for. But I don't think that this court in this case needs to articulate exactly what sort of advisement needs to be given at sentencing or what parameters can or cannot exist that would allow revocation.
Well, we'll quite back into your introductory statement about how this is, these cases really implicate whether or not the defendant is being coerced to give up his right against self-incrimination. The judge isn't saying, I'm sentencing you to work with the SOMB and to tell us about your sex history, maintenance polygraphs, that kind of thing. The judge is saying, you have to admit that you did this crime. And that's inconsistent with the defendant's position at trial.
Here's the way I would think about that. Some offenders who have denied their offense up to the point of being placed in treatment will acknowledge their offense. Those folks, if they have some later trial where those statements are offered against them, they can seek to exclude those on the theory that those statements were coerced by a perception that probation would be revoked if they invoked their privilege. And that would be consistent with Murphy, where the failure to invoke the privilege can be excused if there were sufficiently coercive circumstances. But I think whether those circumstances exist in a particular case need not be decided up front. They can instead be decided and addressed at the time of any subsequent offered use, because voluntariness of statements is supposed to be assessed based on the totality of the circumstances, and the circumstances will vary for each individual. And as to whether they are coerced, there's both a subjective component and an objective component. Subjective in that if the individual does not subjectively feel that his will has been overborne, then there is no coercion, even if a reasonable person in that position would feel coerced. So it has to be a case-by-case assessment that should be made at the time of the subsequent offered use.
Okay. Let me touch on your opposition to a grant of use, derivative use immunity. Tell us why you think that that's unworkable here. You focused in your brief, on how it's not conducive to someone really accepting responsibility for their conduct, and it doesn't yield good therapeutic results. And there seems to be a debate about whether there's really anything from a social science perspective to back that up. I'm concerned, I want to hear you speak to that, but I also am concerned about just the workability of it. If we end up having Castigar hearings, if there are revelations about someone having committed offenses against other children, for example, you have a serial sex assault on a child situation. Am I making sense? So both pieces, if you will.
Well, the main reason for not requiring a prospective grant of immunity is that we are not seeking to override the invocation of the privilege. Once the offender has invoked the privilege, as here, I think that the privilege should be honored and there should be no further questioning. Grants of immunity are only required in situations where, say, someone's been called to the witness stand, they've invoked the privilege, and between the court and the prosecutor, there's a desire to compel those statements over the exercise of the privilege.
Okay. So we're running short on time, so assume for the moment that there is some inclination to go there. Give me your perspective on how that may be fraught with peril from a practical perspective. What problems might we encounter, more accurately, might the criminal justice system encounter in allowing for that?
Well, if I go there, you mean...
If we disagree with you on the point you just made.
Okay. And the thought is that a prospective grant of immunity has to be made anyway. Here's the problem with that. I don't know when it would be made. If it was made at the time the person was placed on probation, it would sweep in individuals who might not have any interest in invoking the privilege. As I said, we have some people who have not invoked. We have some folks who get into treatment and recognize that I've got a problem. I'm victimizing people, and this is my opportunity to address it. It would sweep in them as well, unnecessarily. And there are going to be some individuals who confess to extremely serious offenses that simply should be prosecuted, and there will be instances in which, although it's use and derivative use immunity, functionally it's transactional immunity because there's no way to prosecute the person without the information. And the benefit of addressing it on the back end with a voluntariness hearing instead of a prospective grant of immunity is that if the person makes the initial confession, which perhaps is deemed to have been coerced because of the fear that probation would be revoked, if the person is later approached in a way that's attenuated from the initial coercive interview, those statements could be voluntary and the information could be used, and that person could be held accountable for what might be a murder instead of just remaining in the community on probation. If I may, I would ask to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Can you say your name, Nosner?
Nosner.
Thank you, sorry. Ms. Nosner?
Good morning. May I please accord? My name is Lynn Nosner, registration 39209.
I'm here on behalf of Defender Respondent, Mr. Brian Robertson.
Oh, you're fine. There seems to be a lot of coughing going on.
Okay, let's try this again. The state's argument creates a false choice that either the state's interest in safety or the defendant's constitutional right must give way. In fact, both these interests can be satisfied. A majority of courts that have considered this situation have found that the interests are compatible and both can be accommodated through a grant of use immunity. The prosecution has created this standstill in this jurisdiction by refusing to respect the Fifth Amendment and considering the possibility of use immunity. This court should not adopt the state's position, one, because it's unconstitutional, and two, because there are other ways to accommodate all the interests here without compromising the Constitution. In this state, the legislature has given the district court discretion to place some sex offenders on probation. In accepting probation, a defendant does not automatically waive his Fifth Amendment rights. As the Supreme Court made clear in Minnesota v. Murphy, probationers retain a Fifth Amendment right on probation, which they can choose to assert in the face of incriminating questions. They do not automatically forfeit this privilege. The Fifth Amendment protects against both the use and extraction of compelled testimony. It's not simply a trial right. It can be asserted in any proceeding, civil or criminal, formal and informal, and it covers any information that could provide a link in the chain of evidence.
Could I hold you right there? Mm-hmm. Just because you're touching on what seems to me to be the first and central argument of Mr. Cooper here, and that is, you say it could be invoked in any proceeding, but I take it his argument is, the question though is whether it's one of those situations where it has to be invoked or not. Ultimately, the only thing that it does is protect from the use of that statement in one of these proceedings. It doesn't have anything to do with what you could do to the person as a result of him invoking his privilege, if that's what he does, rather than speak. Could you speak to that?
Yes. Generally, the right is not self-executing, so you have to assert it. And Mr. Cooper's argument that later you would have a remedy, you know, as a voluntariness hearing, that there's no problem with the state placing a penalty on the assertion of the right in the present time, because later, potentially, the statements won't come in at a trial because they'll have to meet a voluntariness standard. That doesn't adequately address what's going on here, because the penalty line of cases says that you cannot place a potent penalty or sanction on the assertion of rights. So there's a violation in of itself in that. And also, in order to protect your core privilege of the statements coming out at trial, you have to invoke. I mean, once you make the statements, the cats are bad and bad. I mean, they may or may not come in later. I don't think it's adequate to say that because you have a potential remedy later.
I guess the question is, you say once you've made the statements, but let's suppose that you don't make the statements. And I take it that's the situation that Mr. Cooper is addressing. And he sort of gave us his view of the penalty cases. Could you give us your view of them with regard to what they say about actually taking away this person's job or whatever the consideration was?
Sure. I think that taken together, the penalty cases lay out some clear principles that the government cannot penalize an assertion of the Fifth Amendment by imposing sanctions to fail testimony that has not been immunized. That compelling government interests cannot justify an infringement on the Fifth Amendment right or override the requirements of the Fifth Amendment, and that immunity is the rational accommodation between the imperatives of the privilege and the legitimate demands of the government. Yes, a majority of the cases involved public employees and loss of jobs or public office, but nothing in the language of those cases suggested it was limited to grand jury proceedings or public employee. And what's common is that the penalty is sort of a loss of a liberty interest or something significant. And here we're talking about the loss of Mr. Robertson's liberty of being in the community. I mean, that is huge liberty interest. And the imposition of incarceration would be a sufficient penalty under those cases. When Murphy, I would consider Murphy a penalty case, and it follows directly from those cases and applies the same logic and analysis, even though it's a criminal setting involving a probationer. And the Supreme Court in that case said, our decisions have made clear that the state could not constitutionally carry out a threat to revoke probation for a legitimate exercise of the Fifth Amendment privilege.
I'm having trouble following all this because I still think that the condition of probation, and you would agree, was pretty clear, has to at least participate in treatment.
Yes.
Completion of the program is actually the condition, right? And this individual has refused to participate, and that's the whole basis of protecting the community while the person is at large. Why doesn't this person belong in prison?
His condition was actually to attend and actively participate in treatment. And he did attend and actively participate in treatment, just also within the confines of his constitutional rights. I mean, his counsel had advised him, you have a direct appeal, you have this right, and he asserted it upon advice of his counsel, and only with regards to questions that he feared incrimination. He did not, across the board, assert his Fifth Amendment right. He did not refuse to participate in all polygraphs. He refused to answer certain questions.
Ms. Nestor, good morning. Can I follow up on that? But one of the questions he refused to answer was whether he had, sexual thoughts, correct?
I think it was more specific to whether he had fantasies about children, which...
Okay, what's the crime? I mean, I'm not condoning it, but you're saying he's invoking his right to remain silent. There's no crime for thought, is there?
The problem is, if he made statements indicating that he had been fantasizing about minors, that the state, upon retrial, could introduce those statements. Oh, you said you were unconscious, you were asleep, you didn't knowingly do this. Well, isn't it true that you fantasized about minors? I believe that would come in under 404B, or at least the state would seek to elicit that under 404B.
So, okay, I understand your position, thank you.
So that there was a danger that those statements would provide evidence against him in future prosecution.
So do you think that there's a different standard once the direct appeal has been completed, or if the direct appeal has been completed? Are you suggesting that this should apply only in retrial situations? Do you have a Fifth Amendment privilege as long as your conviction is still being appealed, but that somehow you don't have it once the conviction is affirmed?
I think generally your Fifth Amendment attaches, he has a right to assert it in response to any questions where he has a reasonable fear of incrimination. So under the current circumstances, he has a reasonable fear of incrimination and use at a later prosecution because he might be retried.
Well, so then with respect to Justice Boatwright's question, your answer would be different were the case final. In other words, what he's thinking about isn't a crime. There's no ongoing case in which it could be used upon retrial, so therefore he should have answered those questions.
Yeah, so I feel that when his right is triggered is connected to this, was reasonable for him to be feared, the evidence being used at trial against him. And you're right that if his conviction were final and he had no other proceedings to challenge his conviction and gain a retrial, then having thoughts would not be a crime.
So, may I?
For our purpose here,
when does it become final? Is it at the conclusion of the direct appeal, or is Mr. Cooper worries in his briefs, does that continue through potentially through all post-conviction proceedings under 35C, et cetera?
I don't know that you have to answer that for this proceeding, because Mr. Robertson does have his direct appeal pending, and that was part of the district court's analysis. I think that as long as there's potential for that, his right could continue through a 35C proceeding with regard to things that could incriminate him and be used upon retrial.
What about statements that might incriminate him for previously uncharged crimes? So if he's asked, have you viewed child pornography, which has nothing to do with this particular situation, but if he answers yes, might subject him to whole new charges. Or are you drawing a box just around statements that might implicate his guilt with respect to these charges?
I think the Fifth Amendment does apply to uncharged crimes. But the solution here, if this court is worried about, you know, a probationer being without treatment into perpetuity, is to require a grant of immunity, because then they can make the admissions and there's no safety concern if the state believes that the admissions are so critical to the treatment.
Can I ask a question about the use of immunity? We've talked about this a lot, and you all both cite cases, and we've seen cases where it's talked about in other jurisdictions too. I'm missing something here, I guess. If you could, very fundamental, and you could explain it to me. If you were right about what the Constitution protects, and the defendant, by speaking in a situation in which he's being threatened with a penalty that would be improper, that would violate his Fifth Amendment privilege, why does he need use immunity? Aren't those statements then going to be inadmissible?
I don't think it's guaranteed that it's later. I think use immunity would give defendants the equivalent of asserting their right. It would put them in the place same as if they remain silent. So that way, the state's goals are achieved by having probationers participate in treatment without fear of incrimination.
So it sounds a little, if I could just follow up right there, because you're getting right to the point I wanted, it sounds a little bit like what you're saying is use immunity wouldn't actually protect them from use of these statements, because they'd already be protected from that. It's purely for the purpose of giving them confidence that they can go ahead and what? Comply with the requirement without suffering the penalty.
No, use immunity placed them in the same position if they had asserted the right and not made any statements. If they make statements, there's no guarantee that they would then be excluded. I do think, to the extent that the state is arguing here, well, you have this remedy as exclusion, then I said, why not give immunity now? Why not give immunity? It's because the state thinks that they'll be able to use the statements later. Likely they'll come in. I mean, the hope that some later defense counsel would adequately raise the issue and that the district court would necessarily exclude the statements isn't guaranteed. The only way to guarantee your right is to assert and not make statements. Or if statements are critical to admissions, to treatment process, then give them immunity.
Um,
Ms. Nestor.
Can I ask a follow-up question? A little bit unrelated. Should we be concerned about policy ramifications to an extent? I mean, as a former trial judge, if I had somebody that may be amenable to treatment and therefore appropriate for probation on one of these cases, but I realized they weren't going to engage in treatment for 4 or 5 years, you know, for all of these things to resolve, what confidence do I have to place them on probation? Are we not increasing the likelihood that some of these people are going to go to prison and then we'll reconsider after all the appeals are taken? Or is that even an issue we should consider?
I mean, I think granting use immunity solves that conundrum.
But we don't control that. I mean, ultimately, is that not an executive branch function?
I think this court could reason, like the Court of Appeals visions that have addressed this, and like the district court, that the state cannot revoke a probationer for asserting a Fifth Amendment right. And cannot compel statements absent a grant of immunities, encouraging the state to grant immunity.
But
not all jurisdictions are necessarily taking the same position as the 18th judicial.
All right, so if I'm a district court judge in the 18th and they say, Judge, we don't believe in granting use immunity, you're going to have to deal with the fact that this guy is not going to be in treatment for a number of years. Does that not make him a greater risk to the community?
Currently, under the current SOB guidelines, treatment could be modified to accommodate his probationer. I don't think that they're necessarily at creating a greater risk. I mean, the state's interest is in rehabilitation. The treatment providers can work to modify their treatment programs to allow people that cannot make statements or whatever their circumstances are, a more individualized treatment plan for that person.
Can you help me then with the factual part of this then? Because it was my understanding that they did modify his probation to address that, and then they still reached a standstill. Can you, I couldn't glean that from the record.
So initially he was placed in a modified therapy program that they were not asking him questions about the index offense. But his polygraph examiner began asking, and he was attending, taking maintenance polygraphs, but then he asserted his Fifth Amendment right in the context of his polygraph exam that's asked questions about possession of child porn and fantasies about children. And at that point, they automatically terminated him from treatment and probation, filed the complaint to revoke him. So they attempted to modify, but I don't think the polygraph examiner understood. I don't think they quite understood the nature of it, and they still responded by immediately terminating him, versus trying to work through, okay, maybe we didn't completely understand what it means to modify, or maybe the polygraph examiner didn't understand.
I don't know, I'm not trying to be argumentative, but were the questions the polygraph examiner was asking about maintenance, meaning what are you doing now, or were they historically what has happened?
I believe that they were questions about his current fantasies.
But doesn't that go to the safety concern that I was addressing? And I would say
a grant of immunity would fix that, would solve that. Because the government's interest in safety cannot override the constitutional right, and that is what the penalty cases say.
I'm sorry, I'm done.
All right. Back to the penalty cases. We spent some time talking about what was happening with that jurisprudence in the 60s. And perhaps because we kept jumping in quite a bit, we never made it to McCune. And I'm just wondering, if we fast forward to McCune, which seems to be the latest United States Supreme Court pronouncement about this, what do you make of Justice O'Connor's concurrence, because it's a short concurrence, I think there's some ambiguity there, and there seems to be some dispute in subsequent decisions of other courts about what we should do with that. What would you have to do?
I think Mutuna is a very fractured decision that's hard to decipher what holdings or what rule of law can take from it. But I think that it's apparent that five justices would still continue to apply a penalty analysis where the state is trying to penalize a defendant for an assertion of their Fifth Amendment rights. I would also say that Justice O'Connor, the language she uses suggests, and even some language used by the plurality suggests, that their position would not be the same if the defendant in that case had been facing longer incarceration. She, Justice O'Connor, I believe her language, she said that imposition of incarceration would surely implicate a liberty interest. And if that is so, then here the imposition of incarceration would absolutely implicate a liberty interest and be sufficient penalty as to constitute a Fifth Amendment violation. I also think it's distinguishable because it was involving compulsion in the prison context with a loss of television benefits and a change in the housing facilities, where Mr. Robertson is facing the loss of his conditional liberty in of being in the community and being with his family and attending school. It's a much more substantial penalty that he's facing.
Didn't she focus on more than just the severity of the potential sanction? It seemed that she was also talking about the fairness of the process, and I found that to be a little confusing, and I'm wondering if you can help me with your understanding of what she meant by that.
I don't think she purports to be offering a comprehensive Fifth Amendment analysis. I think she's trying to reconcile, you know, the plurality in that decision adopts a new due process test related to atypical hardship, and she's trying to reconcile some of their Fifth Amendment cases, and I'm not sure I know what she meant either, but at least one jurisdiction, I believe it was the Third Circuit, thought that a fair criminal process would stop at the imposition of incarceration. It would, I've argued that I think a fair criminal process would allow a defendant to challenge their conviction through all possible channels. I mean, yes, a jury of 12 found him, but his conviction is not, found him guilty, but his conviction is not final yet. And we allow this for defendants as it's an important check on our judicial system.
That all sounds good to me, except for the fact he's convicted of an offense for which prison is a sanction. And being on probation is not a liberty right, is it? After you've committed the offense and the jury's found you guilty, and probation and safety in the community and treatment seems to be all involved in this ability of a judge, I would say, without abusing his or her discretion to require. So would you respond to that? I understand the liberty interest discussion, really.
Well, I think it is a privilege. But then once it's given, he has a liberty interest in what was given to him, and that's why we afford
all he's done here. And it's very significant, is refuse the treatment that is the condition of him being out in the community.
Well, not exactly. I mean, he didn't refuse treatment. He just asserted his right in accordance with what his counsel had told him. He would like
to... But the treaters assume then that the program is done. They can't accomplish the rehabilitative purpose of getting the person in community on the long term. Isn't that what this is all about?
Actually, one of the treatment providers in this case wanted him to be granted immunity. And I mean, I think they felt like we don't, they did terminate him, but I don't think that was the only way for this to have been handled. And currently, I mean, he's being monitored through other means. He's on GPS, he has a curfew. He's being contained through other methods. I don't know that necessarily there's this immediate safety risk. And I mean, originally at sentencing, the district court was aware what his defense was, and he maintained it, that he was, that this incident had been caused by his sleep sex disorder. And the court still found him appropriate to be placed in the community.
Counsel, I'm a little concerned, I guess, about the breadth of the rule you're suggesting that we adopt. And I'm trying to understand from your perspective where the boundaries of that lie. We've talked a little bit about the duration, meaning whether this extends beyond a direct appeal into post-conviction proceedings. We've also talked about whether it applies simply to statements about the underlying crime versus and or statements that might lead to future charges. And I guess what would be the rule that you would want us to come up with? And the third piece of that is, do you see a distinction perhaps between a probationer who refuses to answer very specific questions and a probationer who simply says, I'm not gonna participate in treatment? Can a trial court view that, those two situations, differently? What are your thoughts on? I'm just trying to figure out what are the boundaries of all of this you would want us to put together?
Well, first, I'm not sure that I'm asking for a rule. I think the district court reached the proper conclusion in this case. I'm primarily asking for you to reject the state's request for relief. But if you are to address the merits, I think the state's position is unreasonable because a use immunity could be granted, and that is the solution to this. And this court should, you know, focus its energy on that and not necessarily. I mean, I also think that the approach taken by the Ninth Circuit in U.S. v. Antelope is an appropriate way. And in that case, they look at unique incrimination and compulsion. So the first question, is there a possibility for incrimination? And I do think the district court could distinguish between someone who absolutely just refuses to participate in treatment and someone who is consciously asserting their right, like Mr. Robertson. I mean, he was not trying to evade treatment. He was trying to protect his rights. And there's a difference there. And that's why, you know, he meets the first prong, because he was being asked questions that were triggering his rights. And then the second prong is their compulsion, or when they threaten revocation and indefinite incarceration. Yes, there's impermissible compulsion. So I think that's a persuasive analysis. This court is looking for a way to handle these cases, but I don't know that this court needs to get there, and this court could just deny his request.
Can I ask you a question very straightforwardly in a short period of time? We've danced around the penalty cases so much. Would it be fair to say your understanding is that the constitutional privilege against self-incrimination not only protects you from the use of incriminating statements, but also actually protects your job? Is that too cryptic? If you don't make the statements under the threat, you're saying you couldn't be penalized by whatever the threat
is.
Is that right?
I am saying that. And I think that's consistent with Garner v. Broderick. And as well as Cunningham. I'm forgetting the specific facts. I have them written down here somewhere, but yes. Oh, I have time.
Yes, I'm sorry.
You are.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cooper, you have a few seconds left.
Justice O'Connor said, citing the death penalty cases of McGautha and Ohio v. Woodard, that the risk of punishment may be acceptable, however great, as long as the process is fair, it's not automatic, and so on. So although McKinley was resolved on the very narrow basis that the circumstances there weren't sufficiently a penalty, that was not the overall assessment of that case. The court asked about what the conditions of the probation were here. Addendum H shows that the conditions were both to actively participate and to successfully complete the treatment.
And so what's your position with respect to what the judge should have done?
The judge should have exercised discretion, recognizing that the Constitution did not prohibit a revocation of probation if that's what the judge felt was most appropriate based on all of these circumstances. One thing about immunity that we did not mention is that a grant of use immunity really only is a tool for the defendant to later establish that those statements can't come in. If later prosecutors aren't aware of it, if the court isn't aware of it, the offender is still going to need to come into court and say, I have use immunity. So some assessment will need to be made later, and that can be made even without the grant of use immunity, because it is in every case. Colorado need not leave sex offenders in the community for years. It is not required by the Constitution, and it puts the public at risk. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Thank you, Ms. Meisner. We appreciate your arguments. This case will stand submitted. I appreciate you all from coming from Colorado College. Did I hear that correctly? We appreciate you coming to our oral arguments today. We do have some law clerks present in the audience, and they may be able to answer some questions about our procedures, not about the case, but about our procedures if you have some. Jeremy, if you could help out and see if there are any questions. Otherwise, the court is in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.